that incident was a split second for us. As soon as we got out of the car, we had to make a decision to defend ourselves because we were in a position where we were about to be killed by this person that swung this metal pole at us. And unfortunately, the people that followed this on the media, which it went into the media quite a lot, got to make, you know, put their two cents in for that split second decision that we made. And at that time, we were doing the best that we absolutely could with what we had available to make sure that we were the ones that also still went home at the end of the day because we had families.
I'm Sarah Kearns and welcome to the podcast. This is a safe space to discuss the topics affecting everyday families. Let's take an inside look into our own realities and the realities of others. We'll learn together as knowledge creates empathy. Empathy shapes the way that we act and those actions can change our family and those around us. This is the Conscious Project. Have you ever wondered how police deal with trauma? Deal with seeing traumatic event after traumatic event and then just eating their lunch like nothing had happened. Meet Tash, a woman brave enough to speak about how PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, changed her life, her career, and how she moved into the next stage of her life. This episode discusses adult content relating to traumas witnessed by police. Tash was involved in a police shooting early in her career and her mental wellness began to decline. This is her story of trauma, rock bottom, and a beautiful rise to happiness. Hi Tash, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such an interesting conversation, I think, when we all know that when two police get involved, they love to chat and chat and chat and work comes up a lot. And I think it's the same with former police and it's that little insight into what our life used to be. So I've been really excited to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Me as well. And I think it's just that thing, we have that thing in common. So it's natural that we talk about it.
Yeah, and it's so nice to give people an insight into what policing is because it's one of those careers that everyone has an opinion and we all, even other police, watch the news or we watch a scene and we all have our opinion on how it should have been handled, you know, all the armchair experts out there. But it's one of those jobs that until you're in it and until you are under adrenaline and under the pump and having to make a split second decision, you just don't understand what that's like. So it's interesting to speak to people that do and be able to share that with those who don't.
Yeah, and I'm absolutely happy to. I can't wait to have a good chat with you.
What made you decide to join the police?
Oh gosh, I joined when I first got accepted to the police academy at 19. So I was a Hunter Valley girl thinking, you know, didn't like sitting behind a desk, wanted to do something that was meaningful and exciting, and put my application through and I got accepted at 19. So I wanted to, you know, have a really good crack at it and put in for Sydney. So I packed up and moved to Sydney when I graduated at 20 and learned very quickly that it's not exactly what it seems on the outside. As much as I really wanted to help people and make a really good difference, it was very reactive in all the things that we did. So kind of bursted my bubble a little bit once I was in there.
Yeah, it's not. I used to say, okay, this wasn't on the brochure.
Yeah. this is not what I signed up for, but actually it kind of is. We just didn't know.
Exactly. So we're quite similar like that. I also joined at 19 and I think that they may have changed now. I mean, this was what, 12 years ago, but all you had to do was have your green piece, which kind of meant you had to be at least 19. And there was a bit of a fitness test, a psychological exam that you sat through, like a bit of a screening. And that was it, and a bit of a health check with a nurse and you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. I do, because I joined 2010. So what's that, 11 years ago now, so not too long ago, but in a way it is a long time ago. Lots changed. And literally it was put your paperwork through, do your test, get your medical clearance, psych clearance. They might chat to your neighbours and your household partner just to make sure there's nothing dodgy going on. that's it. You're off to Goulburn for 8 months.
Yeah. And it's life is never the same again.
100%. But I wouldn't do it any other way. I still look back and go, you know what? I have no regrets. It was some of the best and worst times of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally empathize with that. So what was being at the academy like for you? Can you sort of explain a little bit for people that don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny, my poor mother, she drove down with me and my then boyfriend at the time, not together anymore, but they sobbed. Dropping me off, you know, I was, you know, just 20 going down to do something amazing, and they had to drive all the way back to the Hunter Valley from Goulburn. And when I got there, I was so excited. It was one of my most favorite times, just being on campus for 8 months, really immersed in it. And you did everything from learning about all the legal terminology and the laws, making sure that you know exactly what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, things like ethics, but also getting in there and learning how to shoot for the first time and learning how to defend yourself and getting into the fitness that was required down there. I had such a great time. It was one of my most favorite memories of, you know, the police was getting in.
Yeah, I loved it too. And you live on the campus. For people that don't know, there's, you know, the old girls' towers and boys' towers, and it's, you know, everyone's got this tiny, tiny little room, and it's it becomes your entire life. And I think that the police academy is a really good start to show how police generally continue on, because it really does become your entire life. You socialize with other police, you work with them. It's crazy hours, and it becomes your whole world. It's hard to then have anyone else involved that doesn't understand what it's like.
Yeah, definitely. And you make friends from the academy that last a lifetime. So some of my friends that I've had in the police, we were friends from the academy. And still today, even though I'm out of the job, I'm still friends with a lot of them.
Like, everyone has work colleagues and things that they really connect with, and, you know, work wives and work husbands and things like that are the common jokes. But until you've spent 12 and a half hours in a car with one other person and you're seeing traumatic events and you're dealing with that together, it's hard to even appreciate the kind of levels that our relationships with our colleagues get to.
Absolutely. And you learn so much about each other so quickly, because you are in the car for such a long time that it's natural that you break the silence with conversations, and it's just organic that you connect. You're in the job, you already are doing the same things, you go to the same incidences, so you can connect on that level that you both experience together. So I actually found it quite hard to make friends post-police, because there wasn't that organic conversation that happened in the car. I had to actually actively go out of my way and bring those conversations out in people.
Yeah. By 9 a.m. on a police truck, you've been there for 3 hours and you're already talking about your own childhood, you know, experiences and what the relationship is like with your partner, and you're dealing with all of those big, big conversations, and really you've only known the person for a few hours.
I know. Like, you know, what you're doing on the weekend, and, you know, do you have siblings? Like, you literally have their life story within
your family first trauma. So you graduate and you join St. Mary's, which is obviously a far cry from the Hunter Valley and what you've been experienced so far at, you know, just 20 years old. So what's life like there?
Gosh, so St. Mary's was, funny enough, I actually put in for that sort of area. I thought, if I'm joining the police, I want to learn the foundations from the people that are really immersed into it. So I had a bit of a rude shock to the system, Hunter Valley girl. Never been in trouble with police, not very many interactions with the bad stuff, to St. Mary's, which borders Mount Druitt and Penrith, for those that don't know Sydney. And it's one of the highest areas, one for domestic violence and issues with low socioeconomic areas, and a lot of murders and a lot of violent crime in that area. So for me, my first shift, we were already in a fight with trying to break up a bit of a brawl. And then from there, it was every shift, something was new, something was happening every couple of hours. It was quite intense. I learned very quickly.
Yeah. My experience being in Liverpool was very similar.
Liverpool.
I remember them strip searching someone on, you know, the side behind this seedy pub, and I was just like, you can't do that here. Like, oh my God, like, I've never seen police like this out in the public, because it just wasn't, you know, where I grew up in this tiny little town on Lake Macquarie. And it's like, this is just so within a couple of days, I was like, right, okay, this is what happens here. Like, it's just, a shock to the system.
Even as little as, I remember the first time 11-year-old boy swore at me, dropped the C-bomb, calling me a C-something. And, we don't swear back home. So for us, it was like, what now? You're 11. Like, what is this? But that was normal. That's the type of behavior that happens out there. And we just had to react and respond to it.
It's awful when you see the children and what they're involved in and how grown up they become at such a young age. And it's definitely very sad.
Yeah, absolutely.
How are you handling it? So you've obviously been thrown in quite deep. The boyfriend that you were with when you went to police college, are you still with him? Are you living together? Have you got that support at home? And what's downtime like?
Yeah, so the boyfriend that I was with at Goulburn, he ended up packing and moving up to Sydney with me, or moving down from the Hunter Valley. God love him. But within a year, you change so much in the police. Yeah. And unless you're in it, a lot of people don't understand, one, the trauma and the toll it takes on your own mental health, but also on your relationships. So we only kind of lasted just over a year after joining the police, and then we went our separate ways. So I'm no longer with him. We were together for about 6-7 years. But I am married to a cop now. So I did, I became one of those people and found someone that had the same sort of feelings and thoughts, and we bonded on the police, and now we're married. So I did come back and become one of those people.
Yeah. So you were obviously going home after these traumatic events, and you're trying to explain your day to your partner, and they just, it sounds like something out of a movie or something out of a TV show sometimes. And I just think, like, he just obviously couldn't understand it or try and even know how to support you.
No. And that's, that's normal for a lot of people. They see the American TV shows thinking that, shootings and all these things that happen in the police are completely normal. So you should know, or you should be able to deal with it. That's what you signed up for. But not a lot of people understand or realize how much of a toll it actually takes on your physical, one, your body, and also your mind, having to see all of that constantly, one day, 1 hour after the next. Some days we had 5 or 6 major jobs in one day that were all traumatic, and we hadn't even processed the first job, let alone the 5th, 5th, or 6th job for that day. So they poor buggers don't quite understand when they've never been in it before.
Yeah. So how were you coping with it while things were still, obviously we'll talk about when PTSD rears its ugly head, but what were you doing in your downtime and your time off work to try and keep yourself well?
Funny enough, once I moved to Sydney, a lot of my hobbies and things kind of shifted, because all of my friends in the Hunter Valley, all of my sporting teams, I ended up leaving to go to Goulburn and move to Sydney. So for me, my downtime was very much around, coming home and just having some quiet time, or going to the gym, or seeing family. I'd drive up the coast to see some family. But after some of these jobs that you would come home from, I didn't know that this was happening in the background in my own mind, that my body wasn't coping very well. So it wasn't until it was kind of too late before I realized that I actually had to start doing something. I couldn't see the signals. I didn't know what the signals were. And it was such a stigma in the police that even if you did have issues, you would never say it, because you don't want to, one, lose out on promotions, or be seen as someone that can't hack it, especially as a woman in the police. It was so, so hard out there.
Yeah, that was going to be my next topic. So being a woman, and it is a lot, there's a lot more women in the police now, but back then there were, like, I know I was one of the only ones that graduated and went to Liverpool. I was like one of the only girls.
Yeah, definitely. So there was 2 of us that graduated and went to St. Mary's, but on my team, some days I was the only female working, or there might have been 1 or 2 of us, and the rest of them were guys. And it was great. It was like having a bunch of big brothers. They were very protective, which was really nice. But at the same time, you're having to compete with your place in the police and show that you deserve to be there. So if you can't hack it, it's frowned upon in that sort of area. That's that stigma that's attached to it.
Yeah, no one wants to be the partner that can't be counted on, or that can't hold their own when things go bad, because obviously other police aren't there to babysit police. They need to help the community. So everyone needs to be able to hold their own. And it's you go in as a woman, I think you've already got something to prove.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Sometimes I still go back to that mindset as well. I always have something to prove. Just, you know, we grew up that way 10 years and, you know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. Like, we were at 20, you are still growing up. You're, you know, if your brain development is still not even finished yet, you are still growing up. So it's a lot to have that kind of trauma in those early years.
Yeah. And unless you've had some family in the police, which I didn't have that, or known anyone in emergency services that went through it, you don't get set up in the right way to know. But yeah, growing up, absolutely. I did my 21st birthday working in St. Mary's on an undercover shift.
Yeah.
So I grew up in the police.
So when did things start becoming just, you know, it was just another job to, okay, it's following me home, it's now affecting my life and something's going on here. When did that realization hit for you?
It was probably a couple of years for me. After I was a year in the job was when my major traumatic incident happened. So it was a shooting we were involved in where we had to protect ourselves. But it wasn't until after that, that was probably the big shock to the system that was like, whoa, this stuff actually happens. And then it was probably the 6 months to a year to 18 months following that stuff started to happen. But I was trying so hard to push it aside like it never existed until it got too much, and I decided to transfer out of the area to see if I could start again at a different station. So it wasn't until, you know, like I said before, like it's too late that you realize, because I was pushing away all of the symptoms that were flagging to say something was wrong, but I didn't want to listen to it.
Yeah, you're trying so hard to be okay.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of them are. They just put on this brave face and say everything's fine, but really they're struggling on the inside.
Yeah. So can you tell us what happened with the shooting?
Yeah, definitely. So I was 21 at the time, and it was my partner and I, I'd been in for just over a year. He'd been in for 18 months. And gosh, when I say partner, I mean police partner. And we got called. It was a bit of a weird call to, you know, people fighting in the street somewhere in the St. Mary's area. And as we started responding to this job, it was an urgent job. So lights and sirens are generally what you do to go to these jobs. And we were getting information as we're kind of driving there as well. So all of a sudden knives are involved. All of a sudden they're in the house. There was multiple calls. Now there's knives to people's throats. It was becoming quite serious. So as we're getting there, we're thinking of all the things we're going to have to do when we get there, you know, thinking of the appointments we need to start using, whether it's spray baton. Now that there's knives involved, obviously tasers and guns is now involved. And it wasn't until we got there and we realized how serious it actually was. So it was apparently a home invasion regarding drugs. And there were, I guess, a dispute over that, and that's where the weapons and that they were fighting each other came into play. And so when we arrived, we were met by some people from a local house, and there was blood everywhere. People were screaming, telling us that they're inside still. And all of a sudden there was this guy that came running up the street with something in his arm. It was like a big metal pole. And we thought that was that guy. So I drew my taser, my partner drew his gun, and we tried as much as we possibly can, yelling at him to stop, identifying ourselves as police, stop police. He kept coming at us, and it was literally, you know, a couple of feet in front of me before my partner actually discharged his firearm and shot him. So it was the first time I'd ever seen something like that happen. It was definitely not like the movies. It didn't, you know, end like you thought. You know, they got shot and jumped backwards sort of style. He literally just stopped there. He was stunned. Didn't even realize that what's happened. And then it just kind of snowballed from there. Had to render him aid. Obviously, we'd shot him, call for backup. Backup was, you know, 20 minutes away. So we had to deal with the situation by ourselves for 20 minutes and deal with our passerby people. And then more people came out and more knives were pulled. It was just, it was a mess. Yeah.
That's a lot for two individual people. And I think people just assume, oh, well, they're police, they can handle it. But at the end of the day, you've got two 20-something-year-old kids, people standing there dealing with God knows how many people in trauma with injuries, and they're by themselves.
Yeah. And it's that funny thing where that incident was a split second for us. As soon as we got out of the car, we had to make a decision to defend ourselves, because we were in a position where we were about to be killed by this person that swung this metal pole at us. And unfortunately, the people that followed this on the media, which it went into the media quite a lot, got to make, you know, put their two cents in for that split second decision that we made. And at that time, we were doing the best that we absolutely could with what we had available to make sure that we were the ones that also still went home at the end of the day, because we had families.
Yeah, that's right. And it's so easy to sit back and watch a scene and decide what you would have done, and even other police do it and judge on what actions police have taken and what they should have done. But until you're in that moment with that adrenaline and seeing all the other things going on in your surroundings, it's a very hard decision to know what it's very hard to know what decision you would have made.
Yeah, definitely. And even for us, you know, reflecting on it, going, did we do the right thing? You know, what would happen if this happens? But we can't change anything. And if we hadn't done that, one of us would have been killed.
Yeah. And you do, don't you? You think back on, like, I know I've thought back on plenty of jobs I've been faced with and think, how did I not shoot them? How did I not take further action at that point and have just been so damn lucky that something happened and we got out of it and everyone's okay? Because when you go back and assess the situation with hindsight, things seem a lot, it gets jumbled, your memory gets jumbled, and it's really, really hard to see exactly the steps that, you know, were in front of you and what was available to you.
Yep, definitely. And even back when we had to, obviously this got investigated to make sure it was all above board, which it was, but even reflecting and trying to bring out some of those memories to help retell the story, there were gaps in my memory where my brain has just gone, no, it's too traumatic. We need to shut this part down. And it wasn't until we, you know, we can see the footage from the taser, because it obviously video records of the whole incident, to show that this is what happened in those moments where I had black, you know, spots in my memory.
Yeah, your brain goes, this is just all too much.
Yeah.
So that's obviously pretty huge. So for people that have never been involved in an incident like that, which I can imagine is a fair few, you guys are waiting for backup. It's absolute chaos. There's people that are injured. There's people inside a house that you still aren't sure on, you know, their welfare status and what's happening in there. What do you do next?
Yeah, so we still didn't know what was happening inside that house. We're dealing with what was out the front. So obviously we call urgent backup and we just wait and trying to deal with what we have at the moment, keep this person alive as much as we can, because even though we've shot them, we've got a responsibility to also save them. Yeah. And then once backup turns up, it's pretty well just, you know, project managing the scene. So guys, the guys are in the house still. Can you go please clear it, see what's happening in there? And, you know, other people take over, ambos arrive. Our supervisor, you know, pulls out a crime scene, making sure that everything's secure so that we have this as an investigation now. And then my partner and I get pulled out of the scene completely, because we're now subjects of what they call a critical incident. So it needs to be investigated to make sure it's all above book. So we get separated so that we can be interviewed and make sure that all of our actions are justified.
You obviously go back to the station, you get interviewed, and that's all done straight away?
For this one, it wasn't. So it was quite traumatic, and it was such a big shake that my partner, the poor thing, really struggled. So when we got back, we got drug and alcohol tested, which is standard for all critical incidences. We had to sign a waiver to say that we weren't to discuss the matter until we had been interviewed. So we weren't allowed to speak to each other during this. And then the following day, we were brought back in for a full interview with detectives from another LAC. To make sure it was all, I don't know what's the word,
Switzerland. Independent.
So they bring
police in from another that work in a different area to be able to oversight everything to make sure it's all independent. And I can imagine that your partner is probably the only person in the world that you actually want to speak to at that moment.
100%. And he was the same, the poor thing. Like we did catch up after the interviews and after everything was all done, just for a coffee to talk about what just happened, because we got separated straight away. And just reflecting on what we did and what we saw, and there was things that he saw that I didn't see. And, you know, the fact that we had each other's back, we didn't realize how much we had each other's back until after. But, all we wanted to do was talk to each other.
Of course, yeah, and debrief. It's such a huge, when you're involved in trauma, that other person is so important to your own healing. So obviously the police have things they need to do to make sure the investigation goes well. But from a mental wellness point of view, like, you guys really needed each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the fact that we couldn't talk to any other police because it was under investigation. Mm. And my partner at the time just didn't quite understand on what that looked like. So his involvement was very much, you know, to come and drop some clothes off to me, because they did have to take all of our uniform to have it tested for gunshot residue and all of that as well. So he brought some spare clothes and I got dropped home, and that was it for the day.
So do you have some time off? Do you start seeing a counsellor? Do the police, what do they do to support you through such a traumatic event?
Yeah, so they were meant to give us a couple of weeks off, but because we had to be interviewed, we had to come back the next day. We originally had a psychologist called in that night, which is part of the procedure for a critical incident where you have a support person and a psychologist. But because it was being investigated, they actually pulled us out of the psychologist who was there to not discuss it until it had been interviewed, which was so hard because you just want to get it off your chest. Yeah. And we were so lucky that we had support people that were with the police association. One of them was one of my sergeants, and he knew the process to make sure that we were looked after, that we wouldn't have known otherwise. So, you know, making sure that, you know, the interview that we were taking place, making sure we had legal advice as well. As funny as that sounds, police needing legal advice, but we were being interviewed as if we were suspects in the end. We were in that interview that we normally put the people we're arresting in. So making sure that everything was, you know, taken care of for us. After that, I came back to work because I was meant to go and leave anyway 2 weeks later to Europe. I had a big Europe trip booked. So I went back to work and sat in the station because we weren't allowed to have our guns for a little while as part of that procedure as well. They take our firearms. And then I went on this holiday for a month over to Europe, which was great because then I had got to try and get it out of my head. And then when I came back to get back into things, they have to show that we were capable of still operating and using a firearm. So they do a return to work, what they call is a stress shoot. So you go into head office and you have to redo pretty well your shoot training, your weapon training, and they put you through some psychology as well with a psychologist there to make sure that you're able to still function and go back on the street with a firearm following something traumatic like that.
Yeah. And how did you feel? Did you feel ready to go back in?
To be honest, I didn't. And I'm pretty sure my partner probably didn't either, but it was more of a get back on the horse. You're always better when you come back. Mm. And, you know, it's in hindsight that I look back at that and go, I was not ready. I needed more time to, one, see a psychologist that was more about making sure that I'm well and doing the right things rather than talking about it constantly over and over, not being able to change it. So I think I came back way too early, but once I was back, I was back. And then it showed very quickly as things tumbled after that, yeah, I probably shouldn't have yet.
Yeah. So when you say things tumble, what's actually happening? So a lot of people that are listening will be supporting someone through PTSD, or they will know someone that says to them, oh yeah, he has PTSD, or he's left his job because of that. But I think unless you've lived it or have lived with someone, you don't even know what that actually looks like, and therefore how you can step up and help someone, you know, if they are going through that. So what does that look like for you?
Yeah, the first indication, and my husband's got it now, he's got it down packed, God love him. So the first indication is lack of self-care for yourself. So if I haven't shaved my legs in a while, he knows that something's wrong, that I'm not myself, or, you know, haven't washed my hair. So not looking after yourself is generally the first sign that there's something wrong, that you're not feeling right to be able to even look after yourself. And that kind of spiraled from there. So, you know, it sounds terrible, but, you know, wasn't washing my hair, wasn't shaving my legs, sometimes not even showering, not even trying to get into the shower, staying home and becoming quite the hermit. I'd literally go to work, go via a, you know, 7-Eleven or something for some chocolate and come home and eat it. And that would be my cycle every single shift, just going and getting chocolate and coming home. So caffeine, sugar. The other thing was in the police is because you're friends with police and they're the only ones that understand, you'd always go out for drinks. So alcohol was a huge thing as well. So
yeah,
there was a time, especially after, you know, breaking up with my partner at the time, that was just after the shooting. It was a month later, after Europe, funny enough. I think that was the sign. And wow. So alcohol was something that you would bond with other police. You'd go out and have drinks, yeah, and it became a problem for a lot of us. That was
part of the culture.
Yeah. And then you started relying on it a lot, that's something that you would do. So that was always a sign as well. But avoiding things was another thing that in hindsight, I didn't realize how much I stopped talking about work. People would ask how it was. My response was, yeah, good. And that was it. Or even as simple as, you know, when things got extremely bad, my mind was going crazy. It was starting to create stories that were not helpful. I was imagining myself doing things that weren't very nice to myself. I was reliving that shooting over and over every time I went to bed. And after a while, it got to a point where I was so anxious about even going into the gun room to put my gun on because I had stories through my head. I would hold my breath, get in there, put my gun on and run straight back out again just to get out of there. So
do you mean that you were picturing yourself hurting yourself with your own firearm?
Yeah. It got to that point.
Which has happened before.
Yeah.
In the police.
It has. Yeah.
It's devastating. And then you're going out and working a shift and dealing with more trauma, because I think people forget that police may go to 12 jobs a day, and each one of those is probably the worst day in that person's life. The person that's called, that's their worst day, worst moment, most feared, you know, when they're so scared, you could do 12 of those a day.
Yep. And especially in St. Mary's, it was such a high domestic violence area, and some of the violence were violent. So I was senior on a truck because we always had quite a young crew coming through. So
yeah,
I'd go to 4 or 5 domestic incidences a day. And by the end of it, you're cranky, you're angry, you're getting a short fuse. Your cup is so full that you're starting to actually fire off at all the jobs. Yeah. And it got to a point where one of my junior colleagues actually went to the boss and was just like, I think there's something wrong with Tash. She's so fiery at the moment. Something's not right. And they pulled me in for a chat just to check in and say, is everything okay? Can I take some workload off you? Because I was just overworked and highly strung.
Yeah, so burnt out.
Yeah.
Is there a moment when somebody steps up, whether it be a colleague or a family member, or somebody steps up and says, oh, Tash, I think you need some help here. We need to intervene here.
Well, that supervisor did approach me. And like a lot of women and probably a lot of cops, you get defensive and just go, no, I'm fine. You know, I don't know what they're talking about sort of thing. And I know that was probably my response at the time.
Yeah.
But funny enough, I walked away 2 hours later and came back and gave him my gun and said, I just need a break. And I gave it to him, and they locked it up for a week or 2 weeks. And I sat in the station for 2 weeks just having a bit of a break from the frontline stuff for a little while just to see if that would help calm things down a little bit.
Which, just for people that have never worked in the police, a station shift is not a break. So when Tash says have a break, like, you come in every morning and you have a look on the board and it will have all of the car crews, and we're referring to general duties policing. So obviously there's a lot of sections in the police, but general duties policing is what we're talking about here. And that's when you just basically respond to all the triple O calls, all the calls for help. Every minute's different. So you come in the morning and you have a look on the board and it will say, for instance, Liverpool 15, that on that car, there is Sarah and Tash working together. The supervisors choose who you're going to work with that day. And you then look down to who's in the station and you hope that your name isn't on the station, because it is relentless. Like, you could have 20 people walk in at the same time and be the only person trying to help all of these people, never mind admin sort of work you need to do in there, as well as people reporting on bail. And there's so much that goes on in a station shift. So when Tash says have a break, that I want that to give some indication of how bad it is on the street.
Yeah, definitely. The fact that I'm willing to take more work in the station then go out on the truck and kind of ease your way into it.
That was the worst part of being pregnant, is just like 9 months of station shifts and so much work, because people, and by work we mean ongoing jobs. So somebody makes a report, that means there is further things that need to happen. So whether someone needs to be charged, for instance, a domestic violence victim walks in and says, I'm scared to go home, this is what's happened. We'd take a statement, we would, you know, speak to witnesses and things, and you're calling everyone down to the station. You might get a car crew to go out and pick up the offender and bring him back. So when we say work, we're saying we're building those briefs that we need to present to a court or present for further evidence. So when that person leaves, your job doesn't end. There's so much more going. So when you work a station shift, all of a sudden they're just flooding in, and you leave a station shift with so much work, but no time to do it, because the next day you come back into the station and a whole new bunch of people walk in, and yesterday's stuff, you don't get allocated time to do that stuff.
Yeah. And there was constantly days that I would have to come in on my days off just so that I was uninterrupted to finish some of these briefs for court. And because some of them were quite significant, like this job that we had with this shooting, you know, we ended up catching the offenders. By me, I mean our team. Caught the offenders that did the home invasion. So there was stuff involved for that. But also on the other end, the person that we shot ended up suing us. So I had substantial amount of paperwork that I had to do to try and help, you know, send that off to court as well. So there was never really a day that you could switch off. There was always something in the back of your mind as well, or any other job that you went to, all the domestics, all the deceased, we have to do reports for the coroner and briefs. It's just... Non-stop.
And there's deadlines to all of those when you've got court and things. So paperwork needs to be served on people by certain dates. So you can't just sort of go, but yet the radio is blaring out that there's all these new jobs you need to go to. And you're like, but I really have to get this done for tomorrow for, you know, the deadline. So it's a high stressful situation, policing, even when you're not on the way to a violent job. There is still so many more big stress involved.
Yeah, definitely.
So did the person that was shot not die?
No, he didn't. Right. So he was severely injured.
Came from.
So he was shot in the stomach, and his bowel was cut up a lot and had to have surgery a few times as well. But no, he didn't die. So literally before we were even back at the station with all of our witnesses, a solicitor got involved with the victims, as they say, and a civil suit was put together before it was even the day was finished. So, and that's common. They have a lot of solicitors that see it on the news and go, right, we're going to get some victim compensation for this. Yeah. And for us, we were still quite traumatized by it. We're then having to, one, put the guys away for these victims because they're victims of it, and then they go ahead and sue us as well in court.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So, yeah.
And you're like, I would have really just preferred to not have any of that happen. I would have just preferred to just keep driving down the street that night.
Yeah, definitely.
So what happens next?
So I kind of stayed with St. Mary's for just over my tenure period, which was 3 years. So I was starting to have some really bad issues every day that was happening in that gun room where I had to hold my breath. I was constantly having time off the road with my gun, and I wasn't coping very well. So I decided that I wanted to be a little bit closer to family but still maintain my place in Sydney. So I put a transfer into to Ryde, local area command, and I won a spot there and ended up transferring to work at Ryde back in general duties again. And I lasted about 6 months before all of this started happening again. So still having those dreams, reliving it. I couldn't drive down any of the streets at St. Mary's without being reminded of some of the jobs I started going to. I had quite a serious child death as well just before I left St. Mary's. That was quite traumatic for us as well, that I had to investigate. So I just wanted to leave it all behind and start fresh. But unfortunately, fresh lost its novelty after a couple of months. So I moved into the brief handling office for a little while. So I was in charge of all the court matters and the briefs that went to court for various things, and liaised with the prosecutors. After a little while, it was just getting way too much. I was definitely not looking after myself. I was sobbing at home every single day on the bathroom floor. I ended up taking a month off work just to have a break and try and work on myself. And then I was due to come back, and it was just before Christmas, and Link Cafe happened. And Link Cafe was something that was happening in the city and I didn't attend. So I just want to make it clear I didn't go, but it was being broadcast all over the TV. And all of that sort of thing triggered something within me that I just broke.
So the Lent Cafe siege, for those who don't know, was a siege when a offender walked into the Lent Cafe in Martin Place in Sydney and held, I think it was 18 hostages, hostage for like 16 hours. And police attended, and there's been a lot of criticism on police and their actions and how long it took them. Basically, they sat outside and monitored the situation, really tried to communicate with the offender for a very long time. So it was, when Tash says it was broadcasted for like, what, 14, 15 hours of that.
Yeah. And I was at Ryde Station at the time and, you know, watching it as it's, we've got it on the TV and they're about to send some of our crew into the city for support because they're needing a lot of resource. And I'm panicking going, I don't want to go in. I am not right to go into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it ended up ending with police shooting. And after the offender shot a hostage and another hostage was killed by police bullets ricocheting. So I can see how a situation like that, after you've been involved in a police shooting, how difficult that must have been for you.
Yeah, and even fast forward 11 years, anything regarding guns, unfortunately, is a trigger still for me. So anything that resembles the sound, fireworks, you know, car backfiring, anything loud that's quite sudden, it's unfortunate that it's still something that kind of triggers.
Yeah, and I think Australia is so different to other parts of the world where most people have not ever held a gun or fired a gun. I know I certainly didn't until I joined the police. And holding this firearm is, it's a big responsibility. And in the police, you are taught that it is a very powerful weapon and you are to treat it with respect and you never, ever move around and point it in someone's direction. You don't put your finger on the trigger unless you have decided to fire, you know. Even in the most traumatic situations where I was needing to make a decision whether I would shoot, my finger was still firmly on the receiver and nowhere near that trigger yet until we were taught you do not put your finger on the trigger until you are ready to shoot. So it is really treated as this very dangerous, very powerful weapon. So I think that you, when you have that respect for it, you then also have an element of fear with it because you know its capability. Where a lot of people that haven't held a firearm or shot a firearm may not be able to understand what that fear and what that responsibility feels like.
Yeah, definitely. Or even being on the other side of it as well in the negative sense, it becomes so much bigger.
Definitely.
So after all of that, so Lent Cafe happened, I was, you know, highly traumatized, having some really bad days. I was having such unhelpful thoughts that it was so scary that some days I was like, I just want it all to stop. And so that's when I went into the boss and just said, something's not right. And he sent me home. So that was my first experience of being sent home because of what I didn't know at the time, but I was later diagnosed with PTSD and associated depression, anxiety that was related to some of the jobs that I'd been to. Yeah. And I started my journey on trying to find the right psychologist and trying to maneuver through all this because the support with the police, unfortunately, is just not quite there. They're trying to deal with their own stuff, but also they don't want to acknowledge that this is a problem as well in the police, but it's such a big problem. Yeah. So I worked through, I think I had 3 months off, and each time I was told I had 3 psychology sessions paid by the police, which, you know, is not enough for something like this, especially by then I was 5 years nearly in the job worth of trauma. Yeah. And then I was also getting things like calls from return to work, when am I coming back? And I was sick of getting the phone calls from the insurance company. So I ended up having to tap out and just go, this is too much. And I decided to leave the police just to have a bit of a break away from it. So after I'd officially left and resigned, I wanted to see if there was anything else that I could do with my life again, starting over. So got into, you know, the health and fitness industry and started working for a fitness club, and the trauma was still there. It was still kind of rearing its head, and it was still very similar symptoms, but I was trying the hardest to kind of push it aside. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that it got so bad that I just got to a point where I was thinking of doing something so bad to myself that I couldn't not do something about it. So I had a friend who had talked about a hospital called South Pacific Private, which is in the North Shore at Curl Curl, and they have a PTSD program. And it's a rehab center for a lot of people that are struggling with trauma, but also drugs and alcohol as well. And I ended up checking myself in and spent a month there doing that program. And it was one of the best experiences and worst experiences of my life, but it completely changed the way that I was in regards to this trauma.
Wow, that's massive. And how long were you there?
So it was a 21-day intensive.
Oh, wow.
Plus an extra week for family programs. So it was, you weren't allowed any, obviously drugs and alcohol were restricted. It was no sugar, no caffeine, no entertainment, no mobile phones, no exercise, no work. So you were literally immersed in it with other people going through the same thing. They took out all of the distractions that would stop you from dealing with it. And then they would educate you on how your body responds to it as well. So you got to learn a lot about yourself and a lot about the groups that you were with as well. You were with a lot of different people with different stories, and you had no choice but to kind of let go and let the process work and work through it.
Wow, that's intense.
It was really intense. Yeah. It was a lot of crying.
I bet. That's incredible though that it helps so much. And I assume that that's something that you obviously would have had to pay for. That's something the police wouldn't have helped you with or anyone else would have helped with.
Yeah, and I am okay to do that because sometimes the police, what they do is because it's work cover under the police, they only refer you to SIRA-approved professionals. And, you know, no disrespect for the ones that are really amazing, but there were some terrible ones. And I had to get the ones that were really worth it and made the impact, I paid out of my pocket. So I've got two people that I see, a counsellor and a psychotherapist, that are both paid by myself. And also the South Pacific Private. Luckily, I had top cover on my Uber insurance. So I only paid the excess, which was amazing, but it was $25,000 otherwise for 3 weeks.
Wow. Yeah. So that's something that's so out of reach for a lot of people.
Yeah. And a lot of people that I know ended up adding, and I did myself, I upped my insurance to make sure I was covered. And ended up doing it that way as opposed to paying for it. So at the time I didn't have 25 grand. I just left the police and, you know.
And that's it. When you're generally in that mindset or you're suffering with the disease, you are not making a whole lot of money and working and doing all those kinds of stuff. So, yeah, it would be awful to know that finances could stop someone accessing help like that.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate thing. And I still pay for my own psychology and counselling and I'm okay too, and I can. But for a lot of people, they can't afford to do that. And that's why they're having to go through the SIRA. And that's unfortunate that it's sometimes it's not the best for them.
Do you have any tips for people that might be listening and they can, you know, their partners might be in some kind of emergency service or, you know, high trauma job? I know there's so many jobs that are not just emergencies that are a high traumatic job, and they're starting to worry about their mental well-being. Any tips for maybe first identifying and second, maybe how do you tell someone that you love that you're worried about them? Because like you said, the defensiveness is probably a very common reaction.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely shaving your legs.
Let's just make it clear though that she doesn't have little kids. So I feel personally attacked when you say So if you have a baby or a child, then the whole shaving your legs thing does not relate.
No, it's okay. So mainly self-care. So if you notice that your partner's not looking after themselves, so, you know, what shaving legs was mine. That was my indicator. But
doing something that you always do.
Yeah, and stopping doing things you enjoy. So if there's something that you used to do that you really loved and they've stopped doing it, they've stopped going, stopped exercising, stopped eating. That one's a really big one. Or eating too much sometimes, because we always eat our, you know, eat for comfort. Starting to isolate and not see friends and family was a really big one. I started pushing away my family and my friends quite a lot because I just didn't want to talk to people because they always asked how you were, and I just didn't want to say that I was okay or not okay.
So
I'm lucky that my husband, he ended up coming and doing the family program with South Pacific, which is like a 4-day education power session for him to learn what I learned while I was inside. And we learned some really good communication tips. So we now do things called realities where, you know, when things have kind of boiled and something's happened, we try and sit down and talk about it straight away. So if we're offended or upset by something that the other person's done or said, we get it out before it's actually festered a little bit. It gets our minds in the practice of processing things that have happened that we're not happy about. So that's been super helpful. Otherwise, my biggest is journaling. I journal most mornings to get everything out of my head, all my concerns, my thoughts, my feelings, my creativeness as well. Seeing a really good psychologist or counselor that you trust, and just making sure you're finding time for you, and that it's okay that if you're not feeling like doing something, be kind to yourself that you don't have to as well. Like, don't feel obligated that, you know, you've committed to this 30-person dinner and you're so anxious to go that you don't have to if you don't want to. You can be kind in yourself and just say, you know what, it's not me today. I might try next time. That's okay.
Would you have been receptive to anyone saying to you, Tash, you need help, we need to support you in another way, this isn't working, when you were in that thick of it? Or you know, is there something that people listening that may need to help their partners, or they want to help partners, is there something they can do, or is it really one of those things that they have to come to on their own?
For me, no, I was stubborn. I didn't know until my mum took me for coffee one day and dropped me off at a counselor's office instead. And I still haven't had that coffee. So God, she did a bit of an intervention, and I hated it at the time and I was so cranky, but it was the best thing I did. But looking back in hindsight, if it was someone that sat down with me, and I say this now, it may be different if it was actually the case, and actually sat down and was like, look, I think there's something really going on and I'm here for you. Let's go and see someone together even, and just talk about what work. And I've done that with my husband, and we've gone in together to talk something out when he doesn't feel like he wants to go on his own. I just bring him to my appointment and ask him to come in. And that's been so good because it gives him a chance to talk to somebody as well. Even though I'm there, it's a bit more controlled as opposed to an argument at home as well. And things are building up. So starting with small steps, being kind first. Or reaching out. Like, there's so many people that have now reached out to me since I've left to find out what I do and how I've gone about it and what's worked for me, that having that support from people, even partners, reaching out to Alex a lot as well, my husband, that's so helpful to have people to go to.
Yeah, so it's really about giving them some space but still letting them know that you're there, you support them, you love them, but really it's got to be them that makes that decision.
Yeah, and educating just around myself and communication has helped in that. I know my husband is a very few word person, so if he just gives me the double leg tap or a quick hug squeeze, that's his way of showing me I'm here for you. He doesn't have to have the big, extravagant, you know, life-changing, impactful sentences to make it feel good. That's his way of showing. So just stepping back and going, you know what, let's just embrace this as it is. And, you know, he is trying and that's his way of trying.
Yeah. Yeah. That's lovely. So how are you now? Let's finish on a positive. I'll link all your Instagram handles and stuff in the show notes so people can come along and follow your journey. Cause you're just, policing is one of those things, and same as I know when my husband left the army, it's one of those jobs that really forms your identity. So once it's taken away and you make that decision to leave, although we may end up, you know, like I'm super happy where I am now and the fact that I've left, but gosh, making that final move away was huge. And, you know, I've had to refine who I am and redefine my identity. So how are you now?
Yeah, really good. So I always lead down the place of helping people, and the police, I think, set that into stone for me. So I've now moved fully into the health and fitness industry. So I'm a fitness coach and training to be a nutritional coach as well. And I help a lot of men and women to build confidence in themselves and either, you know, lose weight or build strength. I do a lot of Pilates related, so posture and rehab as well, and just help support them in the right ways to make sure that it's not just a fad and they're doing it with huge restrictions. So I'm trying to bring positiveness to their lives as opposed to all the negatives. And a lot of my clients start out with having some issues, whether it's mental health or, you know, have some kind of goal for weight loss. But I'm actually attracting quite a lot of women that have, you know, polycystic ovarian and endometriosis and fertility issues. And, you know, we've just started going through the works for our own fertility issues and IVF. So I feel like you attract what you kind of put out as well. So I am getting quite a big community, and yeah, it's been really amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You always ended up helping people, and I'm glad you've found that place now where it's much more healthier for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I feel good about it. Instead of leaving the place every day feeling crappy and you know, seeing the worst things in life, I get to share the wins with a lot of people that have set some really great goals and hit them and are working so hard to build better lives for themselves. And you know, I love getting messages from some of my clients saying, oh my God, I'm pregnant, but I still want to train. And what do we do? And we work out a really great way to adapt our sessions so that we can train while they grow and make it such a really good thing that they have leading up to having a baby. So it's one of my favorite moments.
That's awesome. One more thing. Do you regret joining the police, or you'll still always have your heart there?
Yeah, I'll always have my heart there. I absolutely loved and hated it, but I learned some valuable skills and I grew, and I wouldn't have led to where I am now without all of it. I learned so much about myself and learned how to communicate really well and defend myself and be confident. And I think I had to go all through those to get through South Pacific Private to become a really great coach that I am now, and it's doing really well. So
yeah,
no regrets whatsoever. How about yourself? Do you regret anything?
No, loved it. Well, my heart will always be there. I think for me, it was my own mortality became very, very evident once my kids were born. And once we lost our first baby, and then I had a few really traumatic jobs that centered around children, either being mistreated, neglected, pregnant women overdosing, things like that, that really I struggled with because I had lost our baby and I felt it was really unfair.
Yeah.
And it was very hard to get out of that mindset of being, you know, their experience has nothing to do with mine. And once you've got these little babies at home waiting for me, I just didn't want to run headfirst into things anymore that I used to love. Like, I remember hearing jobs on the radio, like on the normal radio at home when I wasn't at work, and thinking, oh, I wish I was working today. Like, that was, you know, there was this big, huge job and I wish I was involved. That sounds so, you know, for lack of a better word, cool. Like, you know, it was such an interesting job. And then once the kids were born, I'm like, oh my gosh, thank God I wasn't there that day. Like, that was so, so terrible, so dangerous, so traumatic. So I think it was definitely a good time for me to leave and leave it to the cops that have got it all under control.
Yeah, we definitely took it for granted back then on how precious and how close we could have been to having some really, really bad things happen if we hadn't 100%. Responded in a particular way, split-second decisions. But, yeah, no regrets either, and hopefully a little bundle of joy in the future for us as well. And I'll be probably then having that conversation with my husband, who's still in the police, about making sure he's careful.
It's so hard. It's so hard. And yeah, we'll all hope to hear some beautiful news out of you guys, and we'll keep following along on your journey.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to us,
Tash. No, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in today. I would love to continue the conversation with you over on Instagram at The Conscious Project Podcast. Hit subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. And I would be so grateful if you would take a moment to leave me a 5-star review. It really does help. Take care.